And I think an important thing of it too is you're not asking for something except
No.
for to learn. And
Yeah.
so it's way more approachable than like, hey, I want to do a networking conversation and talk to you about what I do and you tell me what you do. I really approached it as I want to learn about you. I have some questions and what I'm going to do with that information, I'll tell you about, but isn't really the focus. It's not me selling something or me telling asking for advice. It's me learning through conversations. Now that we're having this conversation, it's also like what I ended up doing with my career, which was doing UX research and talking to people. So it probably was itself its own data point of things I like to do.
Welcome to episode 199 of Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. I'm your host, Candice Ridardi, and today I'm joined by conversion rate optimization specialist, AJ Davis. AJ is the founder of Experiment Zone, which helps online businesses grow their revenue by improving the user experience of their website using scientific methods. Prior to starting Experiment Zone in 2017, AJ led optimization strategy for Fortune 500 companies during her tenure at Clearhead. She was also the lead UX researcher on the Google Optimize product. Our conversation, which centers around AJ's extraordinary feat of having 100 coffees, is filled with actionable advice for anyone looking to make a career move. Yes, it's fantastic content. And the audio quality is not up to par this week. So if you prefer, head over to @GratitudeGeek on YouTube to watch the video and learn why AJ had coffee with 100 people and casually interviewed each about their day-to-day activities in their career and how these conversations eventually led her down her own career path.
Welcome, AJ. You've got some credentials.
Thanks. Great to be here today.
So tell us your story. How did all that happen?
Oh gosh. I mean, it sounds so linear. So I'll describe the linear path, but in reality, like any entrepreneur, we kind of meander into what we do, right? So I started my career actually in finance. So I kind of did something that I hated and ended up having the best thing I ever did for my career was have 100 coffees. So I went and had 100 coffees with people just to hear what they did, learn organically, like, what did you do today? What's like, what do you love about your job? What do you hate about your job? And I met this woman who did UX research and she happened to work next door in a different building at a different bank, but she had such a flair and love for her job because she got to have real conversations with people and then turn that into real change for those same people. And it just really inspired me and kind of set me off on this career path. So I went to school, I studied human factors and information design, got to geek out in some user research labs for a while, and ultimately found myself on this team developing the product Google Optimize, which just sunset back in September this year, which makes me feel like I've been doing this too long. And that part of that team, I was the lead researcher and got to talk to people doing conversion rate optimization, learn all about their day-to-day, learn about how they got to really learn from the real world, and then put out really good experiences that worked for people. And so long story short, I left Google. Got a lot of side eyes. Why would you do that? Went to a really neat company here in Austin called Clearhead. Got to learn by doing and then started my own company in 2017.
That's a great journey. And my favorite part of the story is the 100 coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about that.
I was like,
give you the idea?
I probably. I mean, I was just kind of like this geeky kid in college and in high school. I remember hearing a story about some politicians who were just really good at like connecting with people and learning about them and like finding memorable ways to connect. I was really shy. And so I would always do things like, okay, I'm going to do Toastmasters. I'm really afraid. And now I'm on podcasts and feel really comfortable. And so I think similarly, I probably came across the idea somewhere, somehow of like, just have coffee with people, like learn what they do. And I knew that for myself, I was like, there was some fear there. And so by setting a goal of 100, I knew that I'd get a lot of great conversations. I'd learn a lot. And hopefully by the end of those 100 coffees, I would really know what I wanted to do. And I think it was probably around coffee 70 or so where I was like, yep, this is right. But I kept going to make sure I had found the thing I wanted to do next.
Okay, so a lot of people are going, how did you find 100 people to agree to have coffee with a kid?
You just have to be bold and ask for it. Let's see, it was about 15 years ago. So I think that it just kind of started with some people that I knew at my own company. You know, I was early in my career. People are generally pretty open to giving advice to people in that stage. So I'd just say, hey, I'm trying to figure out what I want to do next and like what my career will look like. I think what you do is interesting. Could I buy you a coffee and hear about it? I don't think I got any no's. So it's pretty easy when people get a chance to talk about themselves. And so I felt like maybe I went into it thinking I'd get a lot more no's and would have to really like try hard to get those conversations. And then the most important thing was that at the end of every coffee, I said, who should I talk to next? And I always got more than one name from each person.
That's fantastic. As a podcaster, I know that people like to talk about themselves. My list of people who want to be on my show is longer than the weeks that I have in the year. People really do. So if you're afraid, I mean, this concept, we're going to do this whole interview about this whole concept because it's we're going to get into your story too, but I want to keep coming back to this, having the 100 coffees and having those conversations. Even if you are way past trying to figure out what you want to do with your life, mm-hmm. you still should be having coffee with people on a regular basis. I do it in my career. I have coffee with random people that I never in a million years would mm-hmm. think that I would want to have coffee with. And then end up having a great conversation. So I think it's a fantastic idea, no matter where you are. And people do like to talk about themselves. So as long as you just keep engaging with people, they will engage back.
And I think an important thing of it too is you're not asking for something except yeah. for to learn. And yeah. so it's way more approachable than like, hey, I want to do a networking conversation and talk to you about what I do. And you tell me what you do. I really approached it as I want to learn about you. I have some questions and what I'm going to do with that information. I'll tell you about, but isn't really the focus. It's not me selling something or me asking for advice. It's me learning through conversations. Now that we're having this conversation, it's also like what I ended up doing with my career, which was doing UX research and talking to people. So it probably was itself its own data point of things I like to do.
Okay, so for the non-geek people who don't have any idea what you're talking about, what is UX?
UX is user experience. And so within that, you know, that there's designers who create the experiences. We'll just think about a website as the most simple way you might use UX. The designer will actually put the pieces together, decide what goes where. Maybe they'll also do the color and the formatting and things like that. As a researcher, I sit next to that team and I help them understand what customers really need or what users really need out of that interface. So we might have assumptions like they need to sign in, they need to be able to find their banking information, they need to be able to create a new account or share information with someone else. But to really understand the context of the person and their underlying needs and the flaws with the current system, you need methodology from research to come and sit alongside that person, create studies, like observe how people use the interface or the design so you can make a better experience and better design.
For the solopreneur, micropreneur who just has their own website, what are three things that you have learned that apply to every website?
Yeah, it's really like three things to answer. So every website is missing this unless they've thought about it. So three things someone should be able to do on your website without trying, which means without scrolling, without clicking to a different page. What is this website about? Who is this website for? And why should I work with this company or this product or this person to do this thing? And a lot of companies kind of start with that third thing and they're telling their own story instead of saying what it is and who it's for. And those two very basic ideas give the person confidence that they've ended up in the right spot. Because a lot of times we're distracted, we're clicking on lots of things, we're on our phone and we're like, why are we even here? And don't make them work, right? Give them the direct information right up front so they know they're in the right place. And then they'll dive into your story and how you help and all those great details.
So all that before the fold, that's a lot to include before the fold.
Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge, right?
When a lot of web designers want you to do this really pretty video, you know, or have this big picture that takes up the whole, you know, first section of the page. And we're answering three questions right there. And the most important question is, who is this for, really? I mean, mm-hmm. because if you're trying to sell clothing to women who are plus size and their hips are wider than their shoulders, and that's your target market. And then on the front page of your website, you've got a skinny chick in a bikini. You're not marketing to the right audience.
Yeah. And I think seeing ourselves in it and being more specific, I think in the marketing world, we talk about having like your marketing niche. And so that's something that if you can name your niche, the niche itself will go, this is for me and I'm ready to do this. And if we say it's for everyone, we're going to miss everybody because they don't see themselves in it. And so if you were making the website and you were selling a product, like let's say jeans for women where their hips are bigger than their shoulders, you might start with that. Like, we sell jeans. We don't need to say that we sell jeans for women with hips bigger than their shoulders. And that itself might be enough. You might not need the why after that, because that's not probably a huge set of e-commerce companies competing like that. Yeah. But you might say like made in America or designed by someone with similar challenge, like who has a similar shape or who's struggled with other stores, or maybe it's like a new brand or women owned or something else that might motivate that same niche to purchase from this particular place. And if you think about it, that's only like 8 to 10 words total.
My husband and I had a custom furniture business and we made king size beds for antique furniture collectors.
There you go.
Because there are no antique king size beds. It's a pretty good niche.
That's great.
Super clear. Nice income.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, there wasn't a lot of competition. Great niche. It's not so much there aren't as many. The antique furniture isn't as popular as it was when our business was doing really well. So I think we got out just in time.
Nice. But I think that there's something in that, right? Like that example itself, your website probably didn't say, we spend hours handcrafting king size beds because we love it and we're passionate about it. And we grew up on a farm and we did it with our grandfather. It said, hey, you're an antique lover and you want a bed that's going to fit your aesthetic.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yep. Spent a lot of time making sure that every single one of those Google keywords was exactly right and dominate, you know, doing everything we could to dominate the keyword. I mean, because back then we did have competition because antique furniture was more popular in the 90s than it is now. So in the 90s we were, or I guess the early 2000s, you know, there was no internet in the 90s, Candace. We started in 99. So in the early 2000s.
It's all the 90s, technically.
In the early 2000s, you know, we did have competition because antique furniture was popular then. It's not popular now. It'll come back because it always does. Mm-hmm. But so we did have competition. So I spent a lot of time really focusing on, I need to dominate the keywords for everything. I need to have the black bed. I need to have the cherry bed. I need to have the tiger maple bed. I need to have the mahogany bed. I need to own them all. So, and that's what you did at Google, right?
Yeah. So at Google, what I did was I worked on the product called Google Optimize. And actually worked on a couple different things while I was there, but really it's like, you think about the role that I had at the company was UX researcher. And so it was really asking questions like, what does the software need to have in it in order for people to be able to do what now I do? And so we spent a lot of time talking to people to figure out not just the marketing of Google Optimize or for these other products, but really like the functionality of it. Like, do you need to be able to color code your folders? Do you need to be able to organize certain information certain ways? And we would come up with research plans and then go talk to people to learn from individual people. We'd go really deep in how they did things so that we could generalize across the population to make things that worked for everyone.
So what did Google replace Optimize with, or did they?
As far as I know, they haven't. So I don't work with them directly in any capacity at this point. So I'm just speaking as a Experiment Zone owner now, as opposed to former Googler. But as far as I know, that is a product they've just sunset, and they've mentioned publicly some plans to replace it, but I haven't seen any updates yet.
So funny. I worked for the North Face for a while in the early 90s. We have this sort of unspoken code among the ex-PNFers, and you just said ex-Googler, and I just thought that was hilarious. Because if you work for a big brand like that, I mean, I'm not going to compare the North Face and Google in terms of brand recognition, but when you work for a brand, mm-hmm. you kind of are part of the whole Googler, PNFer.
Yeah, and they create a culture around it, right? Like, you're really proud for the work that you do and you're connected to the people you work with. And so it has led to connections with people who I didn't know when I worked there, who are similarly people who've left and done other things, or doing other entrepreneurs who are ex-Googlers as well. So it's just one of those things. It's like your college alumni or your job alumni type things, where you just can gravitate towards people who've had similar experiences or similar challenges along the way.
Yeah, there's some sort of commiseration you can do, or collaboration you can do, because you've had a shared experience. Okay, so that goes back to the 100 coffees. So you, early on, you learned how to talk to people that you didn't really know and get information from them. And you took that information to become a researcher, which I you are already doing what you do now when you were doing those coffees, right? But you also had to learn how to get along. I mean, those 100 conversations probably taught you about interpersonal relationships too.
It taught me about listening. You know, I think there's so much to be learned from other people, and that just by asking a question and like giving them space to work it out. It probably also started to teach me about the difference between like a close-ended and open-ended question, which, you know, in my degree in this stuff, like we talk about a lot, how do you structure your questions to make sure the person feels comfortable and you're not leading in them. And I'm sure I led them 1,000 times in each of those coffees. But there's something about not just asking like, are you happy with your job? Yes, no question. What are 3 things you love about your job? What are 3 things you hate about your job? That gets to the interesting thing. My favorite question that I use in my personal life all the time, like if a friend comes back from vacation or they're telling me a story, the question I go to is, what surprised you about it?
Oh,
and that always gives question. People pause. It's always like, huh, I don't know. And then you give them time to think, right? Before you wait, you give them time to think and respond rather than jumping in or trying to suggest an answer. And you'll get to a much more interesting conversation than you would if you said, how's your vacation? Did you have a good vacation? Yep.
Well, so now I have 2 questions for you. So what surprised you about those 100 calls?
I think this conversation today has shed a light on the fact that those conversations were me discovering that I actually was a researcher at heart.
I love it.
I didn't think about that at all. Even though I've mentioned it so many times over the years, I've never thought about that, made that connection.
In this during this podcast, I've helped people come up with taglines for their business. I've helped people realize that their target market wasn't really their target. I've done a lot during this podcast. So people, listener, you should listen to these episodes because I've solved problems. All right. So my question is, what surprised you when you transitioned from being an employee to being a business owner?
That's a great question. I'm going to take a second to think about it because I think a lot. My hypothesis was I could go to business school and learn how to run a company or be in leadership in a company. That was my hypothesis. Or I could start a company and I'd learn the same thing. And the answer is I haven't learned the same thing, but I've learned more important, better things running my own company. I think the thing I didn't know I didn't have the skill for that I now have the skill for is the ability to navigate hard conversations and have both people leaving it thinking it's a win-win.
Ooh, talk to me about that. So how do you do that?
How do you do that? Well, I learned it from a coach. So ask for help is a good takeaway, right? For the first few years, I just was managing it on my own and kind of working it out on my own and using my own ideas or people on my team's ideas. And I did seek out a business coach and have found that to be immensely helpful just to have a sounding board, someone who holds me accountable or reflects back to me things and successes. So she gave me the gift of how to have and structure your difficult conversations. And so I think the way to think about it is 4 things. 1, align on what you do agree on first. And maybe even before that, you might name it's a hard conversation. Hey, this is going to be a hard conversation for me. So give me some grace or patience to have this conversation with you. Take them through the facts, talk about the impact of the facts. And that's where you might start seeing some disagreement, right? We know what the facts are. We agree. The impact generally is agreeable. And then you come up with a short term, like here's this recommendation to address right now. And then here's how we should address it in the long term. And I have not had a hard conversation where I followed that structure, where I felt at the end of it, like, ooh, that went poorly. Instead, I feel like, okay, we've made progress. We have some acknowledgement. We've like moved forward, whether or not we've reached that full resolution or not.
That's a good formula.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everything can be broken down into 3 or 4 steps. Everything. I mean, you want to learn how to fly a plane, you got to learn how to take off, you got to learn how to stay in the air, and you got to learn how to land. You know, everything can be broken down into 3 or 4 steps. And that was a 4 step framework for having a hard conversation. What's the hardest conversation you ever had?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the hardest one was like breaking up with a client where I was like, it's time for us to separate ways. It's hard for a few reasons. 1, I really liked working with them. Like they were personality wise, really nice, good people. And then the other part of it was like the risk of leaving money on the table, right? Like this is a client who's willing to pay me. But it stopped matching where we were as a business and kind of the growth of the company. And so really just teeing up that conversation, making the decision to have it. And then the conversation itself was hard because the facts were there, but I had to be confident about my decision and where I was coming from and what my outcome was before I went into the conversation to make sure things went pretty smoothly. And things were great. The way that we parted ways was really smooth. We've got a good professional relationship now. So I'm really proud of how it went. But definitely going into that conversation was the one I was the most nervous about.
That is a nerve-wracking conversation. And firing a customer, that's not the right way to say it, but terminating a relationship with a customer has been a topic in the last 3 or 4 episodes. I've recorded 199 episodes. You're 199. And I've had that conversation about terminating a relationship with a client in the last 3 episodes. So there's something to be said about it right now. So this is, we're going to go down that road because it is important to understand that not every client is the right client. So what helped you determine that that wasn't the right client? And you did touch upon it a little bit.
I think the more specific thing for us was that our team structure had changed and I needed to have more of my time back to lead the team as opposed to do the work. And for this particular client relationship, it was very dependent on me being available to do the work. And so it was an evolution of my role, an evolution of the team, and just some client relationship stuff around who's the face of the relationship and things like that. So this was another agency where we were doing white labeled work. So we were working under their brand. That was another reason to kind of terminate that relationship at that point. And we were just kind of moving different directions and had different philosophies. So it was kind of like a number of things kind of piled up. And then it became very clear it was time to get some of that time back and have that hard conversation.
All right. So I'm going to use your question against you. What surprised you after that happened? After it was all over, what surprised you?
I love it. I think that's going to be the theme for today. All my questions back. Oh, it surprised me. It surprised me that we left on good terms. I think I'm always, there's part of me that goes into a hard conversation being concerned about how the other person feels, not just the outcome of, the work is done or this and that, but I want to make sure that the impression was solid. The work we did together was great. I really enjoyed working with you. And I want them to really feel that rather than feel like that's sort of the things I have to say. And we ended up having lunch a couple weeks later and it was as if we were still working together and felt really natural. And it surprised me that it felt good to still evolve the relationship in a new way.
Well, and you can be colleagues instead of employee or not a, contractor, contractee, which is nice that you can continue to be colleagues. It's always good. It's always good to be able to maintain those relationships because you never know when you're going to be able to do something for them, make an introduction for them, or they make an introduction for you. It changes everything. So keeping those relationships and continuing to have coffee. Okay. So tell me about your life now. What do you do now that you love? What's the sparkle in your career?
What's the sparkle in my career? I think this is so nerdy, but I did not realize how much I loved creating process until I had to do it for a team. And so the thing that I get most excited about is when I've worked with the team to think about how we do work and how to make it better and how to make it work smoothly. And then I just let it go. And then it works. It doesn't always work perfectly. We sometimes have to make iterations on that. But for me, maybe the area of growth that's been the hardest and is most rewarding day to day is figuring out when to not be the bottleneck and how to better delegate. And for me, creating a process that I understand, I can kind of jump in and see what's going on, but then also can just trust it's working. Has been something that just gets me really excited. So I get to nerd out on using ClickUp and creating custom flows and talking to the team about whiteboarding, all those things. And in a way it's I'm applying user experience design and research concepts to our own team and how we operate. And I've never really had the opportunity to do that operationally before having my own company.
So it's a special person who can use ClickUp and actually stick to it. I mean, I've tried ClickUp. I have so many Trello boards. I've used Notion. It is not the right system for me, but I'm not a process person. I'm an action person, right? And I try to figure out how to get something done in the least amount of steps, which I guess is process, right? So I'm constantly looking for tools that save my, that save me time. And hey, audience, mm-hmm. I'm about to give you an unsponsored tip. My new favorite tool if you're a network marketer, and a lot of you are, is boards.io. I think it's the website. Just Google it. Boards for network marketers. Oh my God. Saves you so much time. And Boards didn't pay me for that. And ClickUp is a good tool if you're nerdy like that, but didn't. ClickUp is more about project management though, and figuring out, you know.
I think it's really only needed for complex like handoffs where it's like, this person does this, then it goes here, and here's our timeline. And this is a really good job of creating that kind of thing. But yeah, there's so many different tools out there.
Which I think is the thing with ClickUp is it's really designed for teams, and I'm a single, you know, a solopreneur. So I don't need to hand off anything on anybody else. I just need to get it done in the least amount of steps possible.
So, you just need to know you did it. Yeah. You could probably just do the paper list if you needed to.
Which I have. I have the paper list. So, okay, let's talk about tools then. So what are some of your favorite tools that you use for marketing and whatnot?
I mean, I spent a lot of my life and my team spent a lot of time in Google Analytics and like tracking, you know, behavioral stuff through data. I think there's some really great, I'm thinking about maybe from your audience's perspective, like if I were just getting started, like what tools I would dive into. And so from that list, something like Microsoft Clarity or Hotjar is a really neat tool that I think if you haven't seen those before,
have no idea what either of those are.
Yeah. So let me take you through it. It's basically, hey, people come to your website and then they leave and you're not really sure what happened. You're like, was it the wrong person? Did they read everything I wrote? Did they even see that part of my about page that I spent like 4 weeks writing? And this tool can help give some insights into that without having to like nerd out on data. So I'll take Hotjar, for example, but you know, Crazy Egg does this. Microsoft Clarity does it. Microsoft Clarity is one of the free options that does it. You can actually see what happens when people come to the website. So you can ask questions and like see in this tool, did they click on this button on this homepage? Like, did they leave without scrolling? You might even like put up a little pop-up and ask questions of them, like, what are you here for? Who are you? You know, things like that. And you can interact with them. But to me, it's called Click Tracking Heat Maps is the like more formal name for it. It's a really cool way to just visualize how people are using your website as a very baseline starting place to answer questions about scrolling. What do they see? What are they interacting with? And then you can start to like uncover, oh, maybe my button's not in a visible spot, or maybe my about page content should really be on my homepage just below the hero section. And so you can think about like what's important that people see on your website, and then you can validate with a tool like that. Did they actually see it or interact with it?
Let's talk about the about page. How important is it?
It depends. Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, it depends. So with our e-commerce clients, for example, about pages generally shouldn't live in the navigation because people aren't there for you. They're there for themselves, right? Like I'm here to buy my pickleball shoes for next weekend's tournament. And I want to know how fast it's going to get to my house and what the return policy is if I pick the wrong size. I don't really care where your warehouse is. I don't really care why you created the company. Maybe I'll dig into it, but that's not why I'm here today. So for that kind of situation, where it's more transactional, the about page really shouldn't be in the navigation. If you're a consulting company like us, you probably care about who AJ is. You might want to know about my background. And so we see more people interact with that content and kind of dive into that. Now, I think there's kind of this careful weaving of stories. So a lot of the website templates will have home, about, services, you know, contact us. And our site is structured like that, but we try to take content that matters and put them together. So you'll see testimonials across the site. You'll see about us information across the site. And that's because it just more naturally fits the actual way people use websites than read each of the chapters of my website.
When we had the furniture business, it was probably 70% of clients would say something to me on when they, back then they actually called the place and there was, you know, I mean, we didn't have a shopping cart before most people had shopping carts, but people still wanted to call the place and look. And they would say something to me and I'd be like, well, how did you know that? And they would say, I read it on your about page. It's like, oh, I guess they really are reading our about page. It was, I mean, when you're having a custom piece of furniture made, you really want to know that the person who's making it says is really who they say they are.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a credibility thing. Even though it was an e-commerce website, it was a very niche website with very specific clients that we've dealt with. But if we were mass producing stuff, I don't think it would have been as important.
Yeah. And you can kind of like tease out what really does matter for people to make that order decision and take it out of that about page and put it where it matters. So You know, for example, things like made in the USA, free returns and free shipping, chat support 24/7, like things like that come up frequently as things that people care about in e-commerce or SaaS products. And you can just put it right under the add to cart or contact us form, those reminders about what matters. And it's less that like long paragraph form of the about us page that is often the templates that you see.
And people don't really read that much anymore. They are looking for the check mark, you know, the bullet point version.
They're used to it. We've all kind of started designing the world that way.
I think it's really difficult for me to read a book. I have to either listen to a book or be very, you know, conscientious about sitting down and I'm going to read this chapter. Because I think in bullet points now. I mean, I've been using the internet for since like 95, 96 is when I started using the internet. So what is that? 30 years? So I think like an internet marketer. Bullet point. It's so funny. Back in the day, my husband and I put together a three page brochure and he designed it. And then he gave it to me and I changed all these long paragraphs that he had written in this three page brochure. And I bullet pointed them and I gave it back to him with my changes. And then he put all the paragraphs back. And I was like, dude, we can put the paragraphs on the website on the three panel brochure. We need a bullet point. People just want facts fast. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with me?
Yeah. 100%. And it's actually something I had to learn too. So to nerd out just on my background for a split second, I was an econ major. I also studied religion. And so I was very good at writing long technical essays. And I then went to work in finance where we had to make slides. And so I was like, my data's right. My story's right. Like I have the right words. I was very careful about it. And the feedback I got was your slides are really dense. And I was like, but how are people supposed to understand it without all the words? And that was like truly the first gift I've been given of feedback in my professional life of if people can't read it in a single line, they're not going to keep reading it. So having these like long bullet points that wrap three or four times, they're not going to get through it and they're not going to retain it. Mm-hmm. And then I learned later why that's true. And this is what really sticks with me for why bullet points matter is that our short-term memory can't handle more than 5 to 10 things at a time, on average, 7 things at a time. And so if you overload people to the point that their short-term memory starts to give way, they're not going to remember what's happening. And so 3 to 5 is a great rule for kind of packaging stuff up so people can truly remember it despite whatever their capacity is for short-term memory. And it's the other reason we give speeches and stuff that are like, tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them and then tell them what you told them. It's the same deal, right? Like your bullet points do the same thing. Your email should do the same thing. Your website should do the same thing.
Have you been in Toastmasters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I mentioned it.
Yeah, formulas. But that formula also works when you're writing an essay. Mm-hmm. Tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them what you told them. Okay, sorry, I interrupted you because of the Toastmasters thing. But when people are reading your PowerPoint presentation, they aren't listening to you. So that's another reason why you kept that PowerPoint really short. Mm-hmm. Do you want them reading or do you want them listening? You want them listening. You want them looking at you and listening.
Yeah. I actually think that's another like maybe thing I've reflected on over the years is I think I used to want them to read it. I was like, well, I'll just stand up here and I'll read it to them and they can read it. I don't want them to pay attention to me. And as I've gotten more,
you were shy.
I was really shy. And so as I've gotten more, like more confident talking to people, more flexible talking to people where I could just improvise the actual words coming out, I stopped putting words on the slide. So now when I give conference presentations, maybe I'll have one question to prompt something, or I'll just have an image and then talk about it. And it challenges me as a presenter to like keep that thread going, to know the kind of type of thing I want to talk about, but not construct it all ahead of time. And it gives them like something to look at in case they don't want to look at me, but then they're still listening to me.
I make the right number of slides in a slide deck for me to be prompted to remember what I'm supposed to talk about. Mm. If that makes sense. The slides are for me, not for the audience.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They don't have a lot of information on them, but they're okay. This is what I'm talking about now. And then go into what you're saying. So, you know, and you can do that with a photo. Mm-hmm. It just needs to be a cue to remind you what's next.
Right, right. Exactly.
There's another hot tip. Okay, so tell me what tell me about your business. Tell me who your clients are and how you help them and all that good stuff.
So we help companies that are growing. So they generally have a website, they're doing some like investment in their digital marketing through SEO or paid ads. And there's two sides of that equation. It's get people to your website and then get the people at your website, if they're the right fit, to purchase or to reach out or contact you or to convert is the word that we use. And so we specialize in that second piece of the puzzle. We take the traffic that you get or the people's attention that you're capturing, and we make sure that the right experience is in front of them. So generally, the companies that are trying to grow want that percentage to be higher so that all the dollars they're spending on marketing are paying off. And we want to help them make sure that they're doing it in a way that's like in line with their brand and values. And so what we do kind of in the details is that we grow their revenue by running A/B tests of different experiences on their website to figure out what's going to lead to the best experiences and the most profitable experiences for the business.
So you're not managing their marketing, you're working alongside the marketing manager.
Yeah, almost always we're working directly with the CMO or someone reporting to them. Mm-hmm.
So who's a good referral partner for you?
Who's a good referral partner for us?
Yeah.
To us?
Who would send you the best referrals?
I think the people that like who know that our clients need us are people who do the SEO or the paid ads, because they know they're doing all this work to get traffic. They're getting the clicks, they're getting the attention, and then it just drops off. And so it's not currently worth the cost benefit of paying for those ads or those services. And they know that as soon as they start bringing us in, we'll like level that out. And then every dollar they spend bringing someone in will have a much higher ROI on the other side because it's a better experience.
Who would you bring the most value to? Like who would you be a referral partner to?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the folks that we are referring business out to tend to be folks that do big design projects or development shops who can help implement the kinds of things that we're learning on the data side, because we often will see things and we'll say, we can keep helping you incrementally get there, but you might need to do this bigger change or this bigger investment. And that's where we end up doing a lot of referrals out.
So it's a circle.
It's a circle.
Marketing folks come to you when their ads aren't working,
mm-hmm.
try to figure out why they aren't working. And then when you see that you've identified a problem, you can take it back to the marketing folks.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Then they go to the development team who like makes those changes, and then they're ready to remarket those and remarket's the different term, but to then do marketing again. And so they come back to the original partners who referred us, and it's a win for everyone, right? We're just helping the business grow by really fine tuning the whole marketing machine.
I have a Thursday, the first Thursday of the month, I offer a free marketing class or a free business class for anybody who wants to come in. I mean, it's solopreneurs, micropreneurs who come in. And this morning I was talking to a CPA about his class that he's going to teach in March. Mm-hmm. And he was giving me all of these ideas for what he wanted to teach. And I was like, dude, most of these people don't even know how to read their balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
What I really need you to do is teach them how to read their P&L, their balance sheet, and their cash flow statement, and explain to them why they need to be able to read these.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you do, only on the market, you know, with the website.
Right.
You
right.
Know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We're going to pinpoint exactly what's tripping customers up or tripping up potential customers, right? Is it the structure of the site? Is it the message of the site? Is it the design of the site? And it can be really big picture concepts like that, or it can be really fine tuned, like what button color should it be? Should it be a chart or should it be a table? And like we have the methods to be able to, you know, fine tune the websites all the way down to that kind of level of detail.
So what button color should it be? Like,
it depends. Yeah, the button color one is the example all of the software tools that we use will demonstrate. And then I always start with saying, you can run those tests by yourself because they usually don't matter too much. We're going to help you uncover like the real issues and then find real solutions to tackle them. But I think the button color is just like a pretty natural thing to think about, because we've all seen a button on a website. We've had trouble finding them on a website. And sometimes if there's not enough contrast, we would recommend making that change.
Well, I personally think that just going to your website and looking at the colors of your buttons is enough for people to understand how important it is to make the button colors right. Because the first thing that I see when I come to your website is the big green Get Started button. And is that the way you've designed it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's your website? What's your URL?
Experimentzone.com.
And I want to know, audience, drop in the comments, come to gratitudegeek.com, look for episode 199 and put it in the comment. When you go to experimentzone.com, what do you see first?
And I'm actually going to follow up with a free method tip, which is my favorite, very sophisticated design tip. Not really at all. But it speaks to what you just described. So one thing is like what grabs your attention, and we just kind of can think about it and find it. My very favorite thing to do, and I would have all your listeners do this for their own site, is the very famous squint test, where you pull up your website and you squint your eyes and you see what you can see when you're squinting, because that is what people will notice first before they're thinking about it. This like pre-attentive processing is what draws your attention. And that needs to be the main thing you want people to do.
Unfortunately, all I see is the green button now because I've already identified the green button.
But you could go to any, like any brand website. You could, you know, actually Amazon fails this a lot. If you go to their website, it's very hard to figure out where your attention should go. Yeah. But if you go to the product page, it's very clear. And so Google search is a great example of one that does it very well. Like if you squint, there's still only the search bar. Like we all can picture that page, the blank search page, because they've designed it with your focus in mind.
Google recently did something where they've added underneath the search bar, like pictures of the websites that you've been to recently. And I want them to take that away. I don't want those buttons there.
I also remove that every time. Whenever those pop up, I'm like, hide that. Cause yeah. I also just want search. Yeah.
I'm there to search. I'm not, if I want to find a website that I have been to before, I'm going to go to my favorites or my bookmarks. If I want to look for something, I'm going to come to Google directly. So, yeah. Yeah. They need to fix that. I know you're not in there anymore, but you've got to know somebody who works there still.
I'm sure they're seeing the feedback.
All right. So 2024 is around the corner. What are some of your predictions in your zone of genius for the next year?
I think we're going to continue to see a bridging of in-store experiences and digital experiences. Ooh. So I think that's something that there was work being done before COVID happened. Then digital became hyper-focused again. And I think with people just generally going out more, you're going to start seeing more integration between like, what's the purpose of a store? Why do you go to a physical store? What's the value of that versus the convenience of shipping it to your house, having exactly the right size? There's some e-commerce stores that have played a lot, like push this to an extreme where they maybe only have one size of everything at their physical store and you're just there to try it on. That might continue to be the case elsewhere. But I think like that integration between those two experiences still is disconnected for most brands. And I think there's just tons of opportunity that we're going to continue to see evolve next year and beyond.
That's actually a pretty genius idea. I'm just here to try it on, ship it to me. With Amazon, I hate to admit this, but you know, we do shop at Amazon. Sometimes those shipments get here the same day because we have a distribution center very close. And so if you go in and try something on and you're like, oh, I don't want to wait 2 weeks for it to get here, shipping is getting so fast. And if they're, you know, if you're just there to try it on, I bet you they can get it to you quickly in that kind of scenario. So back in, it was episode 129 and we're now episode 199. So it was quite a few episodes ago, 70 episodes ago. So that was more than a year ago, about a year and a half. July of 2022, I interviewed a guy named J.B. Hilliard. He's an author of dark fantasy novels, and he is working with a gentleman on the Melderverse, where you can be inside of a video game and you can tap on something and it'll open up a coupon for a free soda at Subway. I mean, that's just an example. I mean, this is happening, people. It is happening. That was a year and a half ago. So I'm sure that it is really close to launch or has launched, you know? So yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on with your prediction that we're going to have.
I was just picturing like how much money is spent in marketing of large scale films and like how much BMW pays for their car to be in whatever movie, right? Yeah. And you could imagine a more integrated experience where you're like, oh, I really like that outfit. Let me like click to buy it. Where, you know, it has to be very carefully designed because we don't want to feel like we're spending money to then be advertised to. But these little shortcuts of information connection is what becomes a good customer experience, because it's not like in your face that it's for sale. But if there's some sort of like quick way to do it, get the information, add it to cart, get it delivered by the time you're home for the movie, like that would be awesome. I think I would love that experience.
Well, and the amount of money that's spent on video games is just disgusting. So people really take their video games seriously. So if they have to do an in-game spend and then it gets them a real world something, you know, I think that that's such a great idea. So all of there's going to be so many amazingly groovy things happening, and they're going to happen sooner than we expect. Because if COVID taught us anything, it's that the world can move a lot faster than we think it can. We can really push things out quickly if there's a need and a desire. And I definitely need to change the color of my button on my website, because I looked it up on my website.
What are you going to do? What color are you thinking?
I'm going to change it to my pink instead of the blue.
Got it. It's all about contrast. So that's the design lingo for it, is we're looking for things that, you know, like white and black. That's why books are written in black text with a white background. It's why when you go to dark mode, it's a dark background with white font. Yeah. We're always looking for things to stand off from each other. And your button is one of the most important things to have contrast.
Yeah, that button needs to be the pink, not the blue. So now I know. Thank you. Thank you for that. I helped you earlier by identifying how important those 100 conversations were. And you helped me decide that I'm changing my button color.
And going to get you more clicks on your site.
More clicks to join my marketing coffee club, which is exactly what I want. All right. Perfect. So this is your moment of gratitude. Unless there's anything else you want to add. Is there anything I didn't ask you want to talk about?
I mean, I could probably think of 1,000 things, but I feel like we made some good ground today. It was very fun.
Awesome. Yeah. So this is your AJ Davis. This is your moment of gratitude. For whom or what are you most grateful?
For whom or what, right?
For whom or what?
So many things. I think I'm in a place now where I'm just really appreciating like community and connection. And so whether that's like professional people that have, the person that came to mind as soon as you asked that question was this woman, Elizabeth Rosenzweig, who was an advisor to me in grad school and has come back into my life over this last year. And we're co-authoring a book together, which I'm not going to talk about any more than that because it's not publicly available or no more information quite yet. But I'm so appreciative of community and connection, because the fact that we could pick up where we left off from 10 years ago and find all these great projects to work on and to like really try to make a difference in our field together, it's just really refreshing. It's very energizing. And I think that that's something I'm seeing pop up a lot this year, is this like kind of openness to reconnect and to keep re-engaging community.
Thanks for tuning in to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Audible, iTunes, Good Pods, or your preferred podcast player. Our theme music is track 14 by Rev Brock and Soul Lily. Make sure to visit gratitudegeek.com for the show notes, where you can find links to all the resources we've mentioned, including ways to connect with our guest, AJ Davis. I've been your host, Candice Ridardi. Stay groovy, my friends.
Stay groovy, my friends.